Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 19th of September, these are our main stories. The American Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has described Saturday's drone attack on Saudi Arabia as an act of war and has again blamed Iran. Human Rights Watch has accused Venezuela's security forces of killing 18,000 people in the past 3 years. And President Trump has stripped the biggest US state, California, of the right to set stricter vehicle emission standards than the federal government. Also in this podcast.
Plants make a lot of decisions about the social context they live in and the distribution of nutrients. And we've, as scientists, have really underestimated how complex the life of a plant is.
We look at the collaborative world of Helianthus annuus, the yellow sunflower. The US Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has described Saturday's attack on Saudi Arabia as an act of war. Speaking on board an aircraft en route to Jeddah for talks with Saudi leaders, Mr. Pompeo again blamed Iran for the strike on the kingdom's oil facilities.
Were it the case that the Houthis' fraudulent claim was accurate, were that true? It's not, but were that true? It doesn't change the fingerprints of the Ayatollah as having put at risk the global energy supply. And Americans and Saudis who reside in Saudi Arabia, too, were at risk. There were no Americans killed in this attack, but any time you have an act of war of this nature, there's always risk that that could happen.
Tehran has denied any involvement. President Trump had previously warned that the U.S. military was locked and loaded in response to the strikes in Saudi Arabia. Our correspondent Nick Bryant told us more about Mr. Pompeo's comments.
Mike Pompeo is a hawk on Iran. He takes a much harder line than the President, Donald Trump. He described this as an act of war as he landed in Jeddah. He said the flight patterns of these cruise missiles showed they had come from the north, not the south, which is the direction of Yemen. He also said that U.S. intelligence is confident that these kind of weapons, their sophisticated weaponry, are not in the hands of the Iranian-backed Houthi rebels in Yemen, and they have not been deployed, to the best of America's knowledge, outside of Iran. He said there was no evidence of them coming from Iraq either. This attack, he claimed, betrayed the fingerprints of the Ayatollah, as he put it.
The intelligence community has high confidence that these were not weapons that would have been in the possession of the Houthis. That's probably the most important piece of information. The second piece is, if you stare at the flight patterns that had to have taken place, given the impact and what you can see when you see the pictures, you should all go hire the best analysts to go look at the damage to these facilities. They didn't come from the south.
Well, meanwhile, Nick, President Trump has instructed the U.S. Treasury to increase sanctions on Iran. Just looking at the whole picture, how serious is this situation now?
Donald Trump tweeted this morning that the United States would apply more sanctions, a ramping up, seemingly, of its policy of maximum pressure. But, Jackie, there's not much left to sanction. And I think what's more significant is that he stepped back from some of the bellicose language he used at the weekend in the aftermath of the attacks on these Saudi facilities. Then he said the United States was locked and loaded, which raised the specter of a military response. And the president seems reluctant right now to pick up the phone to the Pentagon. In June, he abruptly cancelled preparations for a retaliatory strike against Iran after the downing of an American surveillance drone. And I think he's reluctant to do so this time as well. One of his predecessors, Jackie, Theodore Roosevelt, used to say that America should speak softly and carry a big stick. Well, I think Mr. Trump offers an inversion of that phrase. He speaks loudly on Twitter, but he prefers not to wield the stick. He is worried about entangling America in another open-ended war in the Middle East. But that approach has drawn criticism from Republicans who are usually loyal, people like Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, a Gulf partner. He says that projects weakness and emboldens the Iranians.
That was Nick Bryant. Well, Saudi Arabia, meanwhile, has set out what it says is material evidence to back up its claim that Iran was behind the attacks. At a news conference, the Saudi Defense Ministry said the wreckage showed the strikes were unquestionably sponsored by Iran. But a spokesman, Colonel Turki al-Maliki, said the Saudis were still working to know exactly the launch point.
The finding of the investigation, the attack was systematically and intentionally planned to destroy civilian infrastructure. The UAV and the cruise missile used in the attack show advanced capability. Data analysis of the attack sites indicate weapon of Iranian origin. Attack could not have originated from Yemen.
Our Middle East correspondent Martin Patience watched that news conference.
We saw tables and tables of what the Saudis said were fragments of drones as well as cruise missiles. Now, it said 18 drones and 7 cruise missiles were fired at 2 oil facilities in Saudi Arabia. So there were a lot of fragments, and according to the spokesman, these missiles and these drones were manufactured in Iran, and that, according to him, was clear proof that Iran was behind these devastating attacks. Now, I think significantly, what he didn't say is that the launch pad for these attacks was from Iranian soil.
What more did we learn? What more were we told and shown?
He also showed film footage purportedly showing one of the rockets or missiles coming into one of the facilities. Now, significantly, he said that rocket came from the north and not the south. Now, initially, this attack was claimed by Houthi rebels in Yemen. That is in the south of where the attacks took place.
That was Martin Patience. Kirsten Fontenrose has worked in US national security roles under Democratic and Republican administrations and up until late last year served in the White House as Senior Director of Gulf Policy on the National Security Council. She's now at the Atlantic Council think tank in Washington, D.C. Tim Franks asked her, with President Trump instructing the US Treasury to substantially increase American sanctions on Iran, what can we expect next?
That's the big question, because the reason you see sanctions continuing to wind up is because that's one of the few tools the president has access to. You know, unfortunately, when you enter situations like this, there's sort of sanctions and then you leap to kinetics. You know, in the middle, there is this whole field of cyber covert activities, influence operations that don't really fall into the public realm. You won't really see those. And there's a broad game of all of those pieces going on between Iran and the U.S. now, and has been for years, frankly. So the president can choose to ramp those up as well. And all of those authorities exist and are on the books, and all of the departments and agencies know where their limits lie with those. But in the public view, between sanctions and kinetic activity, there are not a lot of options other than working with friends and allies to enable anything that they may do. But even then, there are legal restrictions. We can't, for instance, ask an ally to conduct an operation we legally cannot conduct ourselves. But that's why you're seeing so much in terms of sanctions. I think also the president is trying to send a message by ramping up sanctions today, regardless of how symbolic and non-impactful they might be, because the only calculus that most of us on this side of the water can think that Iran is signing up for here is that the reason for this attack might have been because they want to show the president that they can impact his chances at re-election. And all of the other attacks they've carried out have really not hit home in the U.S. And if they were trying to hit home by impacting oil prices that they know will be relevant to the American voter base, that may be what this was about. And if so, President Trump is trying to show them, this isn't the way to do that, you guys. It's not going to work. You know, I'm not going to respond to this. And in fact, this is not a strongman game. I may talk like a strongman. You may talk like a strongman. The region understands strongmen, but really the strength comes in restraint. If he's trying to send that message, then relying on economic versus kinetic tools is one of the few ways the U.S. has to do it.
Can I just ask one further question about Saudi? I mean, the Saudi authorities are trying to brief, quite possibly with good reason, that they're getting back up to speed very quickly with the repairs, with the volume that they're able to process their oil. But if such disruption is able to be caused, apparently relatively easily, how much of a threat do you think this is to Saudi in the long term, you know, with the forthcoming flotation of Aramco and so forth? Is this potentially of more significance than we're currently giving it credence?
I think it is of great significance to Saudi, to the rest of the world, perhaps not. And I think Saudi is aware of that. And they need to make the world understand that if they go down, everyone goes down. And I think that's why they may have been a bit hyperbolic about the extent of the damage impact when it first happened. You know, it's going to cause 5.7 million barrels a day to come off the market, that kind of thing. Yes, when you evacuate the entire facility and it's shut down for a damage assessment, which was absolutely necessary, that is an issue. But they have been so good at planning for redundancy, and they've known that this was a prime target for attack since, 2006, right? When we first saw the land attack that Al-Qaeda clumsily attempted. So this isn't new for them. And getting things back up shows the resiliency and obviously shows Aramco investors, we can withstand this. If I were them, I would push back the Aramco IPO until this was off the news headlines for sure. But it is a risk going forward. I think if there is escalation, then what Saudi is counting on is that they would see additional facilities attacked. None of them have really up-to-speed counter-drone infrastructure protection. Most places don't. That's not a slam on them specifically. Drones are very hard to protect against. Incoming missiles are very hard to protect against. Patriot batteries and similar defense systems are expensive and have about 8-year timelines from purchase to delivery.
That was Kirsten Fontenrose. Now on to other news. The US-based group Human Rights Watch says Venezuela's security forces have killed nearly 18,000 people in the past 3 years. The organization says most of the victims are people in poorer districts who have protested against the government of President Nicolas Maduro. Here's our America's editor, Leonardo Rocha.
Human Rights Watch says it spoke to witnesses and the families of victims who blamed a police special forces unit known as FIES for the worst violence. The unit was created in 2017 and quickly gained a fearsome reputation across Venezuela. Last week, the UN Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet criticized President Maduro's government for failing to stop the extrajudicial killing and torture of opposition activists. She pointed a finger at the police unit and said it should have been dissolved by now.
That was Leonardo Rocha. Electronic cigarettes or vapes have been banned completely in India with immediate effect. The ban will cover production, sale, import and distribution. The Indian finance minister, Nirmala Sitharaman, said there would be jail terms of up to 3 years for offenders. Responding to the news, one customer at a vape shop in Delhi said banning vaping was silly.
I feel it's absolutely absurd because the government believes, from my perspective, that it's all right to smoke cigarettes and it's all right to smoke tobacco, which is much more injurious to our health than vaping would be. And in fact, vaping is a much better and healthy alternative to smoking cigarettes.
India has more than 100 million adult smokers, making it a huge potential market for e-cigarette companies. Professor Ravi Mehrotra is director of the Indian Council of Medical Research based in Delhi. Tim Franks asked him why he'd been pushing to get e-cigarettes banned.
There are a variety of reasons for that, Tim. In India, we're a very young country. More than 65% of our population less than 35 years of age. And many of them have never been exposed to tobacco in any which way. Unfortunately, if e-cigarettes, which is basically nicotine, is pushed in a big way by the companies, there is a strong likelihood that they would be enticed to start off with nicotine in the first place. So rather than being used for reduction of harm by cigarette or BD smoking, they would be starting on e-cigarettes. Secondly, our problem is that hardly 10 to 15% of our population actually smoke cigarettes. And another 5 or 10% smoke bidis, while the majority, vast majority, about 70% of smoke are actually using smokeless tobacco. So really, cigarette is not our biggest problem. Although 12% of all the people in the world who smoke are in India, it is the second largest percentage of people who smoke. But still, in terms of percentage of people who take tobacco, cigarettes is actually a very small number.
I just wonder whether this ban, I can understand why you've done it, because it's obviously better if people don't use any sort of tobacco or nicotine products at all. But there are other measures that could have been taken. I mean, for example, there's been a move in other countries, notably something that President Trump's just talked about this week, about banning flavoured e-cigarettes, which could appeal to young people. The other thing is that there does seem to be quite a lot of evidence in other countries that e-cigarettes can be used to get people off traditional cigarettes, which are much more lethal.
I will not argue with that. There is definitely evidence from the more developed countries that and e-cigarettes are less lethal. There is no argument on that. But my question is that for a country which is very young, there are many more teenagers going around. Why would you allow them to take up any harmful product in the first place? Danger is still a danger. Would you like to jump off a 10th story of a building or a 3rd story of a building?
Professor Ravi Mehrotra, the director of the Indian Council of Medical Research. Still to come in this podcast.
Children born by cesarean section are at higher risk of health problems caused by a faulty immune system, including type 1 diabetes, allergies and asthma.
Research just released suggesting that babies born naturally have different bacteria from those delivered by cesarean section. The Trump administration has stripped the US state of California of the right to set its own stricter vehicle emissions standards. Announcing the measure on Twitter, Mr. Trump, who has previously denied the science of climate change, said it would not only make cars cheaper, but also much safer. In July, 4 major car manufacturers, Ford, Honda, Volkswagen and BMW, reached a voluntary agreement with California to reduce vehicle emissions. The administration responded by launching an investigation into whether they had violated federal competition law. Tim Franks spoke to the Democratic governor of California, Gavin Newsom, and asked him what he thought of Mr. Trump's decision.
Not surprising, but it's disappointing because the consequences will impact not just California, the United States, but will be felt all around the world.
Well, you can make that argument, but he would say it's not an argument that California should have the power to exercise on its own because it is something that affects the whole country.
The fact is California's economy is the 5th largest in the world, a $3 trillion a year economy. And California has an outsized burden with some of the most challenged cities as it relates to air quality, not only in the United States, but in the world. 7 of the top 10 dirtiest cities as it relates to air quality remain in California. That's what led then Governor Ronald Reagan in the 1960s to do something about the smog in the Los Angeles area, led then Republican Richard Nixon, president in 1970, to establish the Clean Air Act that enshrined the authority for California and has been codified by administration, Congress. Over 100 waivers have been afforded California. So not only have the courts, but the legislature and tradition has dictated California's outsized influence in this space.
But that waiver, as you point out, that goes back to the days when LA used to be blanketed in choking smog back in the 1970s. That doesn't happen now. I mean, you can say it's because of improved standards and that California's been a driver for that. But the point is that California is not exceptional compared to the rest of the United States in the way that once it was.
Not true. Worst air quality in the nation, California. It's not a point of pride that I say that as governor, as a 5th-generation Californian, but that's the facts. And while we cleaned up the smog in Los Angeles, we haven't in the Central Valley in California, Bakersfield, Fresno. It's still stubborn. We're making progress, but we still maintain that unsavory status as the worst air quality in America.
The president has said in one of his tweets today that there will be very little difference in emissions between the California standard and the new US standard, but the cars will be far safer and much less expensive. What do you say to that?
It just made up. It's either knowingly.
Except you don't know yet what the new US standards are.
Well, his standard is he's been very prescriptive, and the fact is he's made it crystal clear. He wants to hold the emissions to an average of 37 miles per gallon versus close to 50 miles per gallon. It doesn't take a scientist to determine that his tweet is just factually inaccurate, and also doesn't take much of an economist to consider the fuel costs and the waste, billions and billions of gallons of oil and additional oil dependency that would be required to deal with the delta between 37 miles and 50 miles per gallon. So the consumers will also be hammered by billions and billions of dollars of wasted oil consumption.
The governor of California, Gavin Newsom. The United States Federal Reserve, the country's central bank, has cut its main interest rate by a quarter of a percentage point. The Fed has set a new target range of 1.75% to 2% for the federal funds rate. A statement from the Fed's main policymaking committee said there were uncertainties about the outlook. Here's our economics correspondent, Andrew Walker.
The US has very low unemployment and the economy has continued to grow. But the Fed chairman, Jerome Powell, said business investment and exports had weakened amid falling manufacturing output. The main reasons, he said, appeared to be slower growth abroad and trade policy developments, a reference particularly to the US trade war with China. Although the Fed is independent of the administration in setting interest rates, it has been heavily criticised by President Trump, who has called its policymakers boneheads for not cutting interest rates much further and more rapidly.
That was Andrew Walker. And staying in the United States, the fashion house Bistroy is at the centre of a social media storm after showcasing its school shooting themed sweatshirts in a series of Instagram images. The sweatshirts featured rips that looked like bullet holes and had school logos emblazoned across the front, including Columbine, Sandy Hook, and Virginia Tech. The image of that one has since been deleted. One of the designers of the fashion label said he wanted to make a comment on gun violence while also empowering the survivors of tragedy. Divya Arya spoke to Anton Gregory, a fashion stylist and consultant in New York, and asked him for his reaction.
It was very provocative, but I think it was provocative in a way that was meant to be provocative, so it kind of invalidated itself in that sense. But it was very insensitive, and I don't think it was an intellectual way to combat gun violence at all.
Well, there has been quite a bit of negative reaction on Twitter and Instagram. I've been reading, people have said, especially relatives of people who died, have felt that this was something that just brought that trauma back. Should there be like a balance between fashion and the impact that it might have on people?
I think when you are going to put bullet holes in high school hoodies, you are ultimately understanding that it's going to cause some type of trauma again to the victims. There's tons of ways to empower the victims of gun violence. One way would be, you know, trying to get your local politicians and getting people together to change gun laws. The last thing you want to do is send bullet hole ridden hoodies down a runway when people are actually dying, when children have died.
Anton Gregory, a fashion stylist and consultant in New York. The prosecution of a former soldier accused of murdering two men in Londonderry in Northern Ireland in 1972 has reached a criminal courtroom for the first time. 13 people died after members of the Parachute Regiment opened fire on a civil rights demonstration in the city. The date of the incident became known as Bloody Sunday. Soldier F, as he's being referred to, was one of 17 former servicemen investigated in connection with the deaths, but the only one to be charged. From Derry, here's our Ireland correspondent, Chris Page.
On the 13th of January 1972, thousands took part in a civil rights march through the Bogside area of Derry. By the end of the afternoon, 13 of them had been killed by soldiers. The date would become known as Bloody Sunday. More than 4.5 decades later, a former paratrooper is facing criminal charges. Soldier F is accused of murdering James Ray, who was 22, and 27-year-old William McKinney. He's also being prosecuted on 5 counts of attempted murder. The families of those who died walked from the Bogside to the courthouse this morning. James Ray's brother Liam said it was an important day.
In a sense, it's a day we have campaigned for 47, 48 years nearly to make somebody accountable for what happened to our relatives. That this is the moment it starts. All we're looking for is due process, and we want that done properly and correctly.
28 relatives were in the public gallery at Londonderry Magistrates Court for a hearing which lasted 8 minutes. Soldier F wasn't required to appear in person because his legal team will be challenging the move to send him to trial in the Crown Court. A prosecution lawyer said the case was complex and involved a significant number of papers. A barrister representing Soldier F requested an adjournment so the defence could consider the documents. He also asked for a court order to maintain the defendant's anonymity, saying the cipher Soldier F had been used since 1972. The prosecution didn't object. The judge scheduled another hearing for the 4th of December. The wider issue of whether former soldiers should be prosecuted over killings from the Troubles remains one of the most politically divisive debates in Northern Ireland.
That was Chris Page in Londonderry. Research just released suggests that babies born naturally have different bacteria from those delivered by caesarean section. The work by scientists from the Wellcome Sanger Institute, University College London and the University of Birmingham may help to explain why children born by caesarean are more at risk of some diseases. Their study has been published in the journal Nature. Here's our health and science correspondent, James Gallagher.
Children born by caesarean section are at higher risk of health problems caused by a faulty immune system, including type 1 diabetes, allergies and asthma. It's thought the bugs that first colonise us could be to blame, as they train our immune system to learn friend from foe. We are not entirely human. Half the cells that make up our bodies are microbes, such as bacteria, viruses and fungi. Most of them live in our gut and collectively are known as our microbiome. This study assessed how it forms when we leave the sterile womb and enter a world full of bugs. Regular samples were taken from the nappies of nearly 600 babies. They showed vaginally born babies get most of their early bacteria from their mother. But Dr. Trevor Lawley from the Wellcome Sanger Institute said C-section babies had high levels of potentially dangerous hospital bugs such as Klebsiella and Pseudomonas.
What surprised me and scared me was the amount of healthcare bugs showing up in these children. It could be 30% of their total microbiome. What excites me is we have an amazing body of data now we can build on and to think about how to properly establish the human ecosystem starting at birth.
The researchers think it may one day be possible to give C-section babies a cocktail of good bacteria at birth. The Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynaecologists said the research was groundbreaking, but it said a caesarean could be life-saving and that the findings should not deter women from the operation.
That was James Gallagher. Now, we might think that plants lead quite isolated lives, but a growing body of research suggests that isn't the case. A study of sunflowers suggests that they're not only aware of each other's existence, but they can learn to share resources. Richard Hamilton reports.
A team from the University of Alberta in Canada found that sunflowers extract nutrition from the soil in highly intelligent ways. When one sunflower perceives a future threat from a neighbouring sunflower, it will suck up the nutrients through its roots as fast as it can before the neighbour can get there. However, if two existing sunflowers have a gap between them, they will tend to slow down their use of this patch so that they can both benefit. It's as if they've agreed not to compete with each other, but to share resources. Professor James Cahill is the lead author of the study.
Plants make a lot of decisions about the social context they live in and the distribution of nutrients. And we've, as scientists, have really underestimated how complex the life of a plant is. One of the things we're finding is no matter how crazy an idea we have, when we do the experiment, we see plants seem to behave in a rational way. And so we need just more crazy experiments that are trying to test what plants are capable of. And then we can start building theories about some of the advantages and disadvantages of different decisions that the plants are making.
So are the plants constantly surprising you?
Absolutely. When I was a graduate student, we were taught that plants just receive and they don't do much. What we're actually finding is that the behavior of plants and plant roots is as complex as we see in social animals and in most any other study system.
This sunflower research adds to existing findings about the complexity of plant life. There's growing evidence that trees can, as it were, talk to each other. A study in South Africa found that acacia trees send out warning signals to other acacia in the form of a gas if, for example, their leaves are eaten by antelopes or giraffes. And scientists in Argentina found that the Arabidopsis, a small cabbage-like plant, shifts the arrangements of its leaves in order to avoid placing its close relatives in the shade.
Richard Hamilton there with the news that flowers can be a lot more cooperative than quite a lot of people.
Take a look at this sunflower. It's
standing so tall. Isn't it pretty? It started so small.
Oh, that is pretty. And that's it from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you would like to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you know what to do. Send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm loving this music. I'm Jackie Leonard, and until next time, goodbye. Shows me the sky. Yeah, it's just love. Water and sunshine makes it so high. It's not looking down on me. It shows me the sun.